going to do 2 Samuel 19 and maybe 20. 19 is still in the outline from last week. So if you still have last week's outline, you're good. It's the one that said David and Absalom. It said 2 Samuel 15 through 19. We never got to 19. We got to the death of Absalom and then David weeping, saying, "Oh, Absalom, Absalom, if it would have been me instead of you." That's where we got. So we're going to continue on this. You know, this is funny. It's like almost deja vu. I have a smaller economics class, and it's like that. Like they all kind of gravitate in this one spot. It's kind of funny. So reminds me of that. Well, it's like, and they all cluster in the same spot. I was like, you guys could spread out. You could have all the room you want because it's a smaller class. But everybody always goes to the same. They do the exact same thing. It's just funny. So, yeah, you do. One, I have a couple students like that too. That say like they're always targeting that one spot. So. Again, we'll get into this in a second. Just really quick, I'm just like brushing off my pants here. My snow story of the day is I was supposed to worship assist for Jonathan today. So Pastor Dinger, and it's about 7:50 or so, 7:45. And I go out and I was like, oh, I partially unburied my car last night. I had shoveled some and I'd created a little path for my car. Well, what I didn't realize is how much of it was going to freeze. Like it was so wet and then it froze. And so I was stuck. So I was back at In and Out, and then I high bottomed getting out. Because the city plow and somebody being a good person, used their four-wheeler and clear our sidewalks. But that pinned me in on one side. And then the city came through yesterday and that pinned me on the other side. And so I started like rocking in and out, and then I high-bought. And so one of our neighbors, apparently they have a farm, and I didn't know this. So she comes and she has this huge, long strap. And so she got her truck out and we tied it to my tie rod and we pulled me out this morning. So I came in pretty hot and I was sweating because I was shoveling and under the car and doing all this stuff. And so I came in and Pastor Dinger had already written down the prayer request for me and everything. And so I was dressed and I got out into the sanctuary at 8:28 and we started at 8:30. So it took me a while. So I didn't have coffee over here. I didn't really, it was kind of one of those mornings. So if I seem a little discombobulated, that's why. I haven't really, I don't know, had a moment to stop. Maybe if that's the best way to say it. So, yeah, exactly. 2 minutes. You're right. Well, what's funny is usually I'm there, and I did text him. Usually I'm supposed to be there at 8 because we sit and we kind of meet and make sure there's no unexpected things. We go through the worship, you know, stuff like that. But this is one of those where, you know, it's not my first rodeo. I've done it a few times. And so he was like, hey, we'll be all right. And so it worked. It came off okay. But yeah, it took me a second to realize I didn't really stop until his sermon. And then I was like, wow, I'm actually tired. You know, it's one of those moments. So, all right. So here we have 2 Samuel 19 through 20. So the handout is the same from last week because we never got to 19. So let's look at this. And so as to recap, David is weeping over Absalom, even though Absalom has rebelled against them, even though Absalom has murdered Amnon, another one of David's kids, even though Absalom is really not a man of high moral character and fiber, it's still his son. And so we get that heartbreaking, one of the most human moments in all the Old Testament. Oh, Absalom, Absalom, if it had been me instead of you. And so this is the reaction. Now, here's the point. David's doing this very, very publicly in front of all of his men. And so they have just supported him against this rebellion. And now he's crying and inconsolable over the enemy. And so that's kind of an insult to the troops. And so that's where we're going to get Joab again, who again is one of the most complex characters in the entire Old Testament. So let's look at Joab here in 2 Samuel 10. I have 20 up here too, if we get to it. 20 is another rebellion, but there's not much in the study Bibles and other things. It's Sheba's rebellion. There's one main point from that that'll matter later if we get time to get to it. It was told to Joab, so starting in verse 1, behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people, for the people heard that day, the king is grieving for his son. And the people stole into the city that day, as people steal in, who are ashamed when they flee in battle. The king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, "Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son." So that, by the way, "Oh, Absalom," I believe is the name of a novel by William Faulkner. I think it's William Faulkner. I've never read it, but it's the same guy who wrote The Sound and the Fury. So he's kind of like Southern literature in the early 20th century. So there's a little reference for you, but it's based on this. Then Joab came into the house of the king and said, "You have today covered with shame the faces of all your servants who have this day saved your life and the lives of your sons and your daughters and the lives of your wives and your concubines, because you love those who hate you and hate those who love you.
For you have made it clear today that the commanders and servants are nothing to you. For today I know that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased. Now therefore arise, go out and speak kindly to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go, not a man will stay with you this night, and this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your mouth until now. Then the king arose and took a seat in the gate, and the people were all told, behold, the king is sitting in the gate. And all the people came before the king. So that pericope there, those first eight verses of chapter 19, there's a lot going on, but remember, this is very, very public. Absalom, so David is in front of all his troops. In front of all of his troops, he's mourning over Absalom. And this is highly inappropriate because now it seems like his troops did the wrong thing. And here's Joab saying, wait a minute, we went into war with you. We've done all these preparations. We fled the city. We created this whole diversionary tactic. You had spies that were working for you, both in the priestly caste. You had all this. There was this whole thing going on. It was a political and military event. And now here you are weeping more for your son, your son who died, than actually in praising our men who actually won this for you. You're going to lose your whole kingdom over this. So Joab actually, even though Joab sometimes does the wrong thing, or Joab sometimes is almost Machiavellian in that he will just do something if it's politically convenient just for the sake of power. So he is not always his redeemable character, but he's got his finger on the pulse of the nation of Israel really well here, because he's saying, look, and you can see that I swear before the Lord, if you don't go, not a man will stay with you this night. In other words, you had a remnant with you when Absalom rebelled. If you keep doing this, you're going to have nobody with you. You have to at least encourage the army and say thank you. You at least have to go out there and say, hey, nice job, man. You know, be the general, be the king. But he's not doing that. He's so consumed with his grief that it's a problem. One of the commentaries I did read on this passage by Robert Barron, he's a Roman Catholic bishop out in California. He has the Brazos commentary on 2 Samuel. He says, emotions are fine and emotionalism can be fine in its place. But when it becomes public and it starts to actually ruin the kingdom of what we would call the kingdom of the left governance, then we've got a problem, right? He's not doing this in private. I mean, you could see that, right? He was crying out in a loud voice and everybody knew about it and the people didn't want to celebrate. Look what it says right there, right? The victory was turned into mourning for all the people. Here they're supposed to celebrate. Yes, we've restored God's chosen one to the throne. And they're like, now we can't even celebrate because we hear the king mourning. And so when it impacts good governance, emotionalism can be a bad thing. One of the things that I like to teach, if you don't know this story, some of you might know this, but I teach ancient Greece. I have a whole class on ancient Greece right now, and I was reminded of this. There's a play that a lot of people, you might recognize this play. One of the most famous plays from ancient Greece is called Medea. And in Medea, it's a big story of revenge, and it involves the story of Jason and the Argonauts. And Jason and the Argonauts, Jason gets this wife who's also kind of like a sorceress. She's kind of a witch type figure. And he has two kids by her, but then for political reasons, he basically abandons her and she feels jilted. And so she just goes on this revenge streak, basically. She's one of the most complex characters in all of literature. But the whole point of the play is that rampant emotionalism and your own desires can actually lead to even more destruction, and that blood reaps more blood, you know, those sort of themes. And so there's some parallels here in that Jason's supposed to be this great political leader, this leader of men. And when he starts losing control of his own household and emotions take control of everything, there's a problem. And for the Greeks, it was balance, a balance of being rational and emotional. Now, of course, in the Old Testament, we would say that rationality is good, but it's, of course, in service to God, the ministerial use of reason. So emotions aren't evil. God created our emotions. Jesus has emotions. But when it takes over, that's when we have a problem. And that's what happens with David here. And Joab calls him out for it. All right, it continues. The second half of verse 8 here. Now Israel had fled every man to his own home, and all the people were arguing throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, the king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hands of the Philistines. And now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. But Absalom, whom he anointed over us, is dead in battle. Now therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing the king back? And King David sent this message to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Say to the elders of Judah, why should you be the last to bring the king back to his house when all the word of Israel has come to the king? Sorry, when the word of all Israel has come to the king. You are my brothers. You are my bone and my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me and more also, if you are not commander of my army from now on in place of Joab. And he swayed the heart of all the men of Judah as one man, so that they sent word to the king, "Return, both you and all your servants." So the king came back to the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to meet the king and bring the king over the Jordan. Okay, so there's a lot of complications here. Some of this is political machinations. First off, David is trying to replace Joab. Did you catch that? So remember, Joab's the one who actually kills Absalom against David's orders, right? Joab had a woman come in to King David's court and like create like this kind of like moral drama story in order to prove a point. And David figures out and is like, "Hey, did Joab put you up to this? Do you remember this?" And so Joab has constantly been somebody that David both absolutely needs, but has to get rid of at the same time. So it's like he needs Joab, but by the same token, Joab's creating all these problems for him. So he's trying to get rid of Joab and keep Joab. And you'll see what happens here a little bit later on in this passage. But he's trying to replace Joab with Amasa. Amasa, it says he's his bone and his flesh. He's kinsman. He's like a cousin, a nephew. He's in that kind of close. He's in his tribe. The other thing that's part of this that you should know, and this is going to matter later in the books of the Kings and in Chronicles, is there's a division between the northern tribes and Judah. And you can see that here, right? Now, Israel had fled every man to his own home. Notice that that's separate from Judah. So those are the 10 northern tribes. And some of the other tribes kind of get absorbed and they do mix and intermarry and some other things. So it gets a little complicated, but these are the northern tribes. So when it says Israel, when it's Israel is mentioned separate from Judah, Benjamin is sometimes included with Judah in the southern kingdom, right? But it's almost always the northern tribes, okay? When it says Israel from here on out. So then David, who is of the tribe of Judah, says to the priests, right, who are from Levi, of course, "Say to the elders of Judah, why should you be the last?" So this is a bit of a political competition. Who was David the king over? Was this just a succession dispute in the family? And then here's Israel saying, "Hey, you know, he saved us from the Philistines, right? Why shouldn't we bring the king back?" And so there's a dispute about who's in charge here. Is David just a tribal king over one tribe, or is he a king over all 12 tribes? This is a dispute, and this is going to matter later. It's going to keep going. Yes?
Is this split the same way it's split between Israel and Judah after Solomon?
Yeah. So Rehoboam and Jeroboam. So when you get to 1 Kings, that's a great question. When you get to 1 Kings and you see the split between what I told my students, if you get confused, RB and JB, okay? But Rehoboam and Jeroboam, that's Solomon's sons. When the kingdom splits after Solomon dies, it splits along these same lines. Yeah, go ahead.
What about Simeon?
So Simeon, in one of the commentaries that I wrote about, I read, that's actually a great question. One of the commentaries that I read, because in the north, there's the two half tribes. It sounds like Simeon has been absorbed into Judah. That's what so I'm going to look that. I read that like last night. So I want to do a little bit more research on that. If you want to research that on your own, also, I'm going to read that commentary again. But it sounds like Simeon has been absorbed into Judah at this point. So something to look into, and I'll look for you. I'll try to remember to do that for next week. But that's a great question because, yeah, it seems like if you do the math, because you have the two half tribes in the north, right? You're like, well, wait, there should be 13. Why are there 12? Well, it sounds like that Simeon has absorbed in. And of course, sometimes also they don't count the Levites. That's another issue. So you got to kind of do some math and kind of go back through the text. But yes, good point. See, my family's contributing here today. This is good. All right. So anyways, it's good. I'm a little discombobulated, so I'm happy for family support in that regard. It's the coffee. Yeah, that's what it is. All right. I let him drink. He's old enough. He can drink a cup of coffee on the weekends now. He's getting there. All right. He's starting now. All right. Okay. So now David's going to run into his enemies. So David's going to be the magnanimous king. So again, he shows moments of being a really kind of troublesome ruler where he's not really doing the job of being a king. He's so consumed with his mourning that he's forgetting that he's a king. But then here he actually shows himself to be a very gracious king. So you get that kind of mix with David. So here we go. And Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite from Barurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. And with him were 1,000 men from Benjamin. And Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, with his 15 sons and his 20 servants, rushed down to the Jordan before the king. And they crossed the ford to bring over the king's household to do his pleasure. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan and said to the king, "Let not my lord hold me guilty, or remember how your servant did wrong on the day of the Lord my king left Jerusalem. Do not let the king take it to heart, for your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come this day, the first of all the house of Joseph, to come down to meet my lord the king." Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered, "Shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because of he cursed the Lord's anointed?" But David said, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah, that you should as this day as be an adversary to me? Shall anyone be put to death in Israel this day? For do I not know that I am this day king over Israel?" And the king said to Shimei, "You shall not die." And the king gave him his oath. Okay, so let's give you a couple of background stories. So you need to, if you want to know who these people are, maybe you missed the last couple of weeks, if you want to go and read back. Shimei is the one that was cursing David and throwing rocks at him as he was leaving Jerusalem. He was cursing him and say, "You're a bloody man. May the Lord do to you what you did to my family," because he's a kinsman of Saul. He's a Benjamite, right? So he was the one that was throwing rocks and cursing David as he was leaving the city. And so he shows back up and he abases himself in front of David. And here's the key thing. He doesn't make any excuses. He owns up to it. He says flat out, "I've sinned. This is my, it's on me. I have nothing." He just throws himself at the mercy of the king. And that's an important thing. There's no excuses. And that's a little bit of a gospel thing for us. Pastor Dinger mentioned this morning a little bit in front of Jesus. He's like, when we're dealing with our own sins or the brokenness of this world, right? You have a variety of different options. And the one that Jesus wants is, "I got nothing. I can't save myself. I'm helpless." And basically, Joy Jonathan said it, Pastor Dinger said it, was Jesus's response, "I can work with that." Right? As opposed to, "I'm going to go earn this off," or "I'm just going to forget it and just ignore it and point out other people's sins," or "I'm just going to ignore," you know, all these other things. No, I got nothing. And we see a little of that here with this man who's wronged God's anointed. David is a proto-messianic figure, right, as God's anointed king. And so Shimei just says, "I've sinned. I got nothing. Just, you know, I'm here. I was the first one to come out here for mercy. I'm showing you how merciful, how humbled I am. I'm not trying to hide it. I screwed up. I have come on this day, the first of all the house of Joseph, to meet the Lord, my King." Okay. So there's a word there a little bit about just being honest with God during the season of Lent. So this is kind of a Lenten action, if you will, by Shimei here. And then we also have another figure here, Ziba. So when Saul died, Ziba was the servant that was running the household. And so we've met him a few chapters earlier because one of Jonathan's sons, right, Mephibosheth, is living with David, the lame son. And so Ziba tries to pull one over on David and say, "Mephibosheth has joined the rebellion." And so Ziba's trying to like get in David's good graces. It's only a couple of chapters earlier. And so Ziba comes out now that David's won and he's still trying to kind of like keep face here. And so David at this time does not know yet that Ziba has pulled one over on him, and that Mephibosheth actually did not join the rebellion. That's going to be tied up in a few verses. Okay, so just letting you know that's why he's here. And then finally, the last figure here, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, that's Joab's brother. Look at what David says, right? "What have I to do, you sons of Zeruiah?" He's like, he's just frustrated with the whole family at this point. Okay, so he's got Joab and Abishai now. Okay, and Abishai is saying, hey, he was cursing the king. He was insulting the king. I'm preserving the king's honor. Let's go kill this guy. And so you see that they're people of action, but sometimes they don't know what it's like to rule. But you can see why they're useful for David, but also a big thorn in his side at the same time, right? So that's who this is. But David actually gives an oath. An oath would have been taken in front of people in public, and it would also have been given in front of God, Yahweh, because you don't take oaths lightly. And so David says that Shimei here, this kinsman of Saul, is forgiven. So that kind of ties that one off. So now here comes Mephibosheth, the lame son of Saul. And this is actually really interesting. And you can read between the lines a little bit. Some of it's conjecture, but it's interesting. "And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. He had neither taken care of his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes." The translation that I had said mustache. And I was like, that just sounded kind of, I don't know, it sounded funny. So I had just, I like had this vision of like Yosemite Sam, you know, like, so I guess beard's probably better. "From the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety." So here's the point. Mephibosheth has been abasing himself and living in mourning ever since David left. But David doesn't know this, okay? And it's because Ziba tried to pull one off on him. "And when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king said to him, 'Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?' And he answered, 'My lord, O king, my servant,'" that Ziba, okay? "'My servant deceived me, for your servant said to him, I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride in it and go with the king, for your servant is lame. He has slandered your servant to the Lord, my king. But my lord, the king, is like the angel of God. Do therefore what seems good to you. For all my father's house were but men doomed to death before my lord the king, but you set your servant among those who eat at your table. What further right have I then to cry to the king? And the king said to him, why speak any more of your affairs? I have decided, you and Ziba shall divide the land. And Mephibosheth said to the king, oh, let him take it all, since my lord the king has safely come home. So Mephibosheth comes off really well here. He's done nothing wrong. He was wrongfully accused. David gives him even a judgment in his favor. He amends his judgment, because before he gave Ziba everything, all of Saul's estates. So he amends his judgment, and then Mephibosheth says, it's just good enough to eat at the king's table. I'm good. And so it's kind of a cool moment. So Mephibosheth is another character that shows up well here. And David, again, being magnanimous, shows up well here too. He doesn't go after Ziba. He just says, look, why don't you guys divide this? Now, if you really want to get detailed, in the Concordia commentary, that big blue commentary, there are some interesting parallels between this account and the judgment of Solomon and the two women with the baby, right? The judgment of Solomon. There's parallels. You can do parallelisms with this. On how, like, one's deceiving the other one, one's making this claim, one's wrongfully accused. There's the idea of dividing things. And so Solomon's going to take this and, of course, in his wisdom, do that in a much greater way. But there's some parallels here. They're interesting. Whether or not you make a lot out of it, you be the judge on that one. But you can make some literary parallels between the two. If you didn't know that, I saw that in the commentary. Just something kind of interesting. Any comments on this before I move to the next one? So two positive stories, or at least cathartic stories, right? There's answers. There's kind of like they're at rest. This lame son of Jonathan is good. He's restored. And then you have this person who is cursing David, and David forgives him, and he is reconciled to the king. So two good stories. Okay. So there's good. It's not all, you know, blood and rape and gore and all those things. There's some good things here. All right. Some other things that have that happen here. Now, Barzillai the Gileadite had come down from Rogalim and went with the king to the Jordan to escort him over the Jordan. Barzillai was a very aged man, 80 years old. He had provided the king with food while he stayed with Mahanaim, for he was a very wealthy man. And the king said to Barzillai, come over with me, and I will provide for you with me in Jerusalem. But Barzillai said to the king, how many years have I still to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I am this day 80 years old. Can I discern what is pleasant and what is not? Can your servant taste what he eats or what he drinks? Can I still listen to the voice of singing men and singing women? Why then should your servant be an added burden to my lord the king? Your servant will go a little way over the Jordan with the king. Why should the king repay me with such a reward? Please let your servant return, that I may die in my own city, near the grave of my father and my mother. But here is your servant Shimham. Let him go over with my lord the king and do for him whatever seems good to you. And the king answered, Shimham shall go over with me, and I will do for him whatever seems good to you. And all that you desire of me, I will do for you. Then all the people went over the Jordan, and the king went over. And the king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his own home. The king went on to Gilgal, and Shimham went on with him. All the people of Judah and also half the people of Israel brought the king on his way. Notice that division again. Do you hear that? Half, not all of Israel, half of Israel. That's going to be important in the very following chapter, because there'll be another rebellion. Okay. So half of Israel is good with David. And then Judah, of course, is good with David as far as things go. And this is again. So what David's doing is rewarding an old man's kindness, right? And this old man's like, look, I've seen it all. I've been there. I've lived my life. I appreciate it, my king. I really do. I appreciate it. But really, I just want to die in peace. And so he's 80 years old. And so David says, great. And so then another servant takes his place and works with David. So it's kind of a cool moment there where David grants this again. And again, good news. This is good stuff for the most part, except for that little ominous note of half of Israel. That is a little ominous. There's some foreshadowing going on. Then all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why have our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household over the Jordan and all David's men with him? All the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is our close relative. Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we eaten at all at the king's expense, or has he given us any gift? And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, we have 10 shares in the king, 10 tribes, right? We have 10 shares in the king, and in David also we have more than you. Why then do you despise us? Were we not the first to speak of bringing back our king? But the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. This division, Solomon's going to keep them together, but this division is going to continue to linger through the rest of David's reign and into the reign of Solomon. So you can see that division here. So there's a lot of foreshadowing. Okay, now, so how does this go? This one, now I didn't give you notes on this because it's pretty brief. The rebellion of Sheba. We're going to get the sons of Beriah again with Abishai and Joab. Joab's not going to take this down lightly. He's a political animal. So David's tried to dismiss him. I got a new commander. My new commander is Amasa. Look what Joab does here. He is the definition of a Machiavellian character where he just, whatever is useful for that political moment, that's what he does, regardless of the morality of it. Okay. So if you never, and by the way, for that reference, that's Machiavelli is the prince, right? And that's the idea. If you read that, like it's a Renaissance classic. The real prince, it's not so much about what's right, but it's more about what's useful. It's really fascinating reading. You read it and you'll be really paranoid of every politician. but not all of it is negative. Some of it is useful, like just practical governing things. But you'll hear that term, it's entered our vocabulary as Machiavellian, the people plotting in the background, the people that do things regardless of the circumstances to keep or maintain their power, right? So that's become into our, entered our common parlance. All right, here we go. Now there happened to be there a worthless man. That's always nice when the scriptures call you a worthless man. Maybe that's my prayer sometimes, right? Lord, you know, Lord, may it be that if there was ever anything written about me, it doesn't say that there was a man in Pocatello who was worthless. You know, okay. Whose name was Sheba, the son of Beer. I believe it's Bichri, but I'm just going to say Bichri because, and that doesn't sound right either because it sounds like I'm swearing. So I'm just going to say Bichri, and that's where we'll go with that. Whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew the trumpet and said, "We have no portion with David, and we have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." So again, there's a dispute. So all the men of Israel withdrew from David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah followed their king steadfastly from the Jordan to Jerusalem. And David came to his house at Jerusalem. And the king took the 10 concubines whom he had left to care for the house and put them in a house under guard and provided for them. But he did not go into them. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living as if in widowhood. There's a reason for this. Those are the 10 concubines that Absalom despoiled, right? That he slept with in public on the top of the roof. Do you remember this? When he was trying, and it was bad advice, but he did this. And so that was incestuous, right? It was an incestuous relationship. Now that Absalom's gone, David basically has said, right, you 10, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to feed you. You're going to be clothed, but you are no longer, you know, I'm still going to care for your needs. And that's actually kind by him, by his standards, by the way. Okay, in this ancient Near East, to take care of 10 women like this who aren't married, who aren't your family. This is, David's being pretty generous, but he takes care of them, but they live as widows because obviously with the pretty high and heinous crime that took place there, they're not marriageable material anymore either by this standard. So they're taken care of, which is a good thing. It's actually pro-women in this case, just so you know. Because in many of the ancient Near Eastern cultures in like Assyria or Babylon or any of those other places, those women could have been cast out or they would have been forced to become prostitutes or something like that, right? So if you read like the Law Code of Hammurabi, or if you read Assyria, if you read Egypt, this is where I recommend, and Pastor Dinger recommends, Is God a Moral Monster by Paul Copan, because of how pro-women the Old Testament actually is. It doesn't seem that way on the surface, but then when you compare it to the rest of the world that it's in circumstantially, it looks really good. You'd much rather live in Israel as a woman than any other country. I promise you that. It's a great improvement over the stuff we see. So just putting that out there for you. Then the king said to Amasa, this is his new commander, right? His new commander. Then the king said to Amasa, call the men of Judah together with me within 3 days and be here yourself. So Amasa went to summon Judah, but he delayed beyond the set time that had been appointed to him. Then David said to Abishai, now Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he get himself to fortified cities and escape from us. Okay, this is pretty easy to explain. The longer we wait, the more troops and the more fortified this rebellion is going to be. And so taking 3 days to mobilize the troops is one thing, but taking even longer is a problem. Okay, and so now he's going to be holed up in the city. So he says to Abishai, Joab's brother, hey, I need some action here. We need to go take this on. I don't have enough time for Amasa here. And they went after them, Joab's men. Notice that Joab's men are listed as Joab's men. There's something different about them. And the Cherethites and the Pelethites, these are David's mighty men. These are his mercenaries, like his private honor guard. They went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. And they were at Great Stone. They were at the Great Stone that is in Gibeon. Amasa came to meet them. So he may have had troops with him, or he may have said, hey, you know, I've got, if you just wait for a day, the rest of the people I've recruited are here. So he comes out to meet them. Okay. Now, Joel was wearing a soldier's garment, and over was a belt with a sword in its sheath fastened on his thigh. And as he went forward, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, is it well with you, my brother? And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa did not observe that the sword was in Joab's hand. So Joab struck him with it in the stomach and spilled his entrails to the ground without striking a second blow, and he died. So Joab, I'm telling you, he's a weird character. So I'm going to give you what this is in the ancient Near East. And this, forgive me, because I'm not going to do this properly. So he's dressed. The right hand was the good hand. The left hand is considered in some cases even the evil hand. In fact, even today, the word dexterous comes from Latin meaning right-handed. So if you're ambidextrous, that means you have two right hands. So that's, in other words, like in the ancient cultures, your left hand was your bad hand, your evil hand. And it's actually called, do you know what's the left hand? What's it called? Do you know what it is in Latin, the left hand? Do you remember this?
Sinister.
It's sinister. The left hand is the evil hand. And so here's what's so you never drew your sword with your left hand. You always fought with your right. If you were left-handed, you learned how to fight with your right hand. Okay, because that was and some of this is superstitious, you know, good luck, bad luck, stuff like that. But anyways, he's wearing all his stuff. And so you'd have your sword sheathed at your left and you draw it out like this, right? So it's on your left and you draw it out that way, okay? And so what he does, and almost everybody thinks that happens here, is as Amasa is coming to greet him, he just has an oops moment. It's fake. He lets the sword fall out. And he's like, oh, hi, my brother. Come over here for a second. And then he says, as he grabs him to do like the greeting, that kiss greeting that they do in the ancient Near East, and he does this, he's got his left hand, the sand that you never use for your sword, and swipes him right in the gut. So it's a deception on Joab's part when he does that, if that helps you. He picks him up and then basically, literally, as you see there, he literally guts this guy, right? It's pretty brutal.
The Old Testament doesn't shy away from this.
Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. And one of Joab's young men took his stand by Amasa and said, whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab. And Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the hot highway. And anyone who came by seeing him stopped. And when the man saw that all the people stopped, he carried Amasa out of the highway into the field and threw a garment over him. When he was taken out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. Okay, what's happening here is there's confusion because they know that Amasa is supposed to be the new general and they see him dead in the road. And then they see the former general and his brother standing over here rallying people. There's a problem. And so they just said, you know what? Let's cover up the evidence. Let's get him out of here for now. And so we can at least have the same mission. So Joab's basically trying to restore himself into his position by assassinating the one that's in his way. It's just, again, it's brutal. This is one of the reasons I believe the Bible's true is it doesn't shy away from this stuff, right? It tells you the truth. That's, you know, including in its, you know, rough and earthy form. All right. And Sheba passed through all the tribes of Israel to Abel and Beth Makkah, and all the Bichrites assembled and followed him. And all the men who were with Joab came and besieged him in Abel of Beth Makra. They cast up, Beth Makkah. I always say that one wrong too. They cast up a mound against the city, siege engines. This is siege tactics, okay? And it stood against the rampart, and they were battering the wall to throw it down. Then a wise woman called from the city, listen, tell Joab, come here that I may speak to you. And he came near to her, and the woman said, are you Joab? He answered, I am. Then she said to him, listen to the words of your servant. And he answered, I am listening. Then she said, they used to say in former times, let them but ask counsel at Abel. This is a proverb. We have no idea what it means. We just don't know what that means. What is this counsel of Abel? It's clearly they knew what it is, but they don't know. We don't know. There's no biblical text. I was reading the commentary. It says, we don't know what this means. If you have a study Bible that has a better note than I do, I don't know. But most of the stuff I was reading, I didn't see it. Okay. And so they settled the matter. I am one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city that is a mother in Israel. Why will you swallow up the heritage of the Lord? Joab answered, far be it from me. Far be it that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not true. But a man of the hill country of Ephraim called Sheba, the son of Bichri, has lifted up his hand against King David. Give him up alone, and I will withdraw from the city. And the woman said to Joab, "Behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall." Then the woman went to all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. So he blew the trumpet, and they dispersed from the city, every man to his home, and Joab returned to Jerusalem to the king. Now Joab was in command of all the army of Israel, and Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was in command of the Kerethites and the Pelethites, and Adoram was in charge of the forced labor, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder, and Sheba was the secretary, and Zadok and Abathar were priests, and Ira the Jerahite was David's priest. Notice it's almost like it doesn't want to say that he's the commander, but he is the commander, right? This is in charge of the army again. So David even tried to get rid of him, right? "I don't want you being my general anymore." So then he's like, all right. So then the next political crisis shows up. Joab eliminates his rival. And then all of a sudden, look who's leading the army again. And yet Joab still serves David. It's really kind of odd. He's really an odd figure. You know, it's one of those you could probably write a book on Joab as a character study, you know, and it'd be a really interesting one, or it'd be a weird kind of probably PG-13 movie, right? Where just like focus on Joab. It would be a really unique, a unique take on things, or a play or something. It just kind of struck me as an interesting figure. Okay, a few things here to comment on, and then we'll be done for the day. First off, this wise woman, we don't have her at name, her name, but women as a wise elder, again, is not common in this culture. And so, again, there's two passages now here in 2 Samuel here, 2 Samuel 20 or 19 and 20, that are positive towards women. You have the 10... concubines that are cared for, which David didn't have to do, but he does. Okay. And he does feel responsible for them, but he didn't have to do that. And he takes care of them. And now you have this wise woman who's actually portrayed fairly positively here, and heeding the advice of her. And this is where, again, I was reminded of the Greek play in Medea. The chorus is the wise women of Corinth. And they're like, in a Greek tragedy, the chorus is like the moral conscience of the play. And so they get out there and they basically say to the hero, don't do that thing. And when he says, I'm going to do that thing, and then it fails, they look at him and say, told you so. That's what the chorus does. Okay. Told you not to do that thing. Okay. And so they're, in Medea, Euripides, the playwright, actually has the women say something along the lines of, hey, we have some good advice. Just listen to it. We don't even want to lead. Just let us listen to our advice. You know what I'm saying? That sort of thing. And it reminded me, because here we have this wise woman giving an advice. So it's kind of cool, these little parallels I was making here in the ancient world. But yeah, and really those tragedies, you know, you could say the same thing about David, you know, the tragedy of David, or even Solomon. Don't add wives and concubines to yourself. And then I told you not to do that thing. And then you do that thing. And then things go poorly. I told you so, right? So there's a little bit of that tragedy here that's very similar, kind of parallels. If you read those ancient Greek tragedies, there's a reason those are still around, right? Is because they're very universal in terms of human expectations and human conduct. Anyway, back to this. Again, it's brutal. He's a rebel. This is a war. This doesn't mean that God's endorsing you to behead your political enemies. Of course not. But what this is in the context of a war and in a rebellion. In this case, it's, you know, for lack of a better term, better for one to die than the whole city to die. Right? And then also notice that she uses a mothering term here, right? She says, you seek to destroy a city that is a mother in Israel. We think what that means is that the city gives shelter to folks, just like a mother does, and that also children are being raised in this city, and that it's a way of propagating the people of Israel. And so the city itself is a mother. You've heard people say the mother country before, right? So this is, in this case, a mother city. So she uses that and says, why would you destroy one that's actually giving life to the country? Why bring death to a place where there's life? And it's probably not insignificant that probably a former mother or a current mother is saying that, right? So you have a mother saying that the city is a mother to Joab, and Joab actually receives this advice, which is interesting. And so then the people of the city decide that we're going to get rid of this person, this rebel, because this is war and we're under siege. And by getting rid of him, it's going to stop the siege. Again, it doesn't mean that the Bible is endorsing that this is what you do in every circumstance. It's just giving, it's reporting, right? Prescription versus description are different things, but it does stop the rebellion, even though it's Joab again, who's the one that's center course in here solving this. And then we get this list. This list, by the way, is slightly different than the list we got earlier in 1st, 2nd Samuel. The main difference here is that there's an extra priest serving David, and that there's also the addition of Adoram in charge of the forced labor. We think that that's because David's starting to prep the temple. He's going to start gathering materials. We're going to see that because the next two chapters are an epilogue, and God has told David that he's not going to build it, but he can do the preparations. And so he's going to make those preparations. And so that's why we have the forced labor here. These are almost always likely war captives or people from or prisoners even, or even criminals sometimes were used for forced labor as well. And so you had a division. You had to have somebody leading that, right? You have to have somebody, it's the chain gang, so to speak, to actually get things done and to be productive in society. And that's who they are. All right, we're about right at time. Does anybody have any comments or questions for us on this one? Because just so you know, we're going to finish David before Easter. Because we're going to be in 1 Kings. We're going to be in Solomon. Because the next passage is an epilogue. It includes David's last words. It includes a psalm that's included both in 2 Samuel. It's his last kind of psalm that's recorded there. So we're going to look at that. And then we're going to get to 1 Kings. And we're really going to spend a lot of time in Chronicles also. Because that's when it really starts to parallel. It's with the rule of Solomon and the temple. All right. Comments, questions on that? So that means next week we're going to do the epilogue, if you're following my logic here, and the following things, some of those ancillary things left over. We good? Everybody? All right. I think I'm mostly myself again. All right. Let's say the blessing on ourselves. The Lord bless us and keep us. The Lord make his face shine upon us and be gracious unto us. The Lord lift up his countenance upon us and give us peace. Amen.
If you have any questions or comments, email them to podcast@gracepocatello.org. And make sure to subscribe to our channel to stay up to date on sermons and classes at Grace Lutheran Church in Pocatello, Idaho. This podcast is designed so that you can take grace with you anywhere you go.